This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Keller's Garden Center and Landscaping Services. Winter is here, and I encourage you to save your back this year. Contact Keller's today and get a quote for residential or commercial snow removal. And also, it is never too early to start thinking about spring. COVID has put a delay on so many things. Do not delay in getting yourself set up with one of the best in the business when it comes to getting your yard looking its best. Visit Keller's at their location on Kern Street in Exeter, Pennsylvania, just down the street from Blue Ribbon Dairy, or head over to their social media pages for more information. Welcome to the PopGo Project Podcast, a platform for the discussion and discovery of arts and entertainment. We focus on highlighting people and events that add value to the world around us. Visit us on all social media platforms by searching the PopGo Project or visit our website at thepopgoproject.com. Welcome to the show and thank you so much for listening. We're live, kind of, recording, but it's live right now.
Yeah.
What's up? Welcome to the show.
What's up, John?
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm probably the oldest person in the history of this show.
You might be.
I don't know.
You might be. We'll see what happens. But I'm joined today. What's that?
That's quite a title he's going for there.
Yeah. Oldest on the show.
Yeah.
But I'm joined today by Aaron Fink, a member of many bands, Gentleman East, Lifer, Stardog Champion. I'm probably going to miss one or two, but most notably, former member of the band Breaking Benjamin. And I'm joined also by his father, Gary Fink. So thank you.
Hey, Dad.
Hey.
And the reason I wanted to say,
you remember Seed. Seed, oh, Seed, anybody knows that one?
No, I don't know that one.
That's my high school band.
Okay. Did I miss
that's
any?
What happens when you have dad on a show?
Yeah, I mean, currently I'm in Lifer and Earshot.
Oh, Earshot, right.
Yeah, and then occasionally we do a Gentleman East thing.
Yep. Were you part of the Badleys at one point too?
Yep. I was in the Badleys for a couple of years there in the late 2000s, I think. Yeah.
And we can't forget your solo career as well.
Yep.
Lots going on. Lots of history here. And the reason I wanted to do this was because I saw recently Aaron was sharing some information about a book that his father wrote called Amped. And it's about, the father following along his son, who's been in a national rock band. And it's funny because, like, so I've known of, Aaron, as a member of Lifer, back in 2001, like I didn't know him, but I knew of him. I was a big fan of that band. And then obviously when he joined Breaking Benjamin, I was kind of in awe of that just because it was a huge band, a lot of success. The way Aaron, just kind of played his guitar, it was like I liken it to just a construction work with a hammer. It was natural. It was cool to watch, all that kind of good stuff. And I remember him doing a show. It was 2005, I want to say, at the Staircase in Pittston, and it was for a Katrina benefit. And I remember after the show was over, a bunch of us went to the waterfront in Plains, Pennsylvania, and Aaron was in front of me. And I was kind of just like kind of starstruck. I was a young kid. I was 22, 23. And there was this rock star in front of me. And he never portrayed himself to be like, above anything or better than anyone else. It was just, but for me, it was like this really wild thing. And then I was fortunate enough to get to know Aaron on a personal level as the years went on. My work with The Weekender and the radio station and doing this. And I'm honored to be able to call him a friend of mine. And so back then, I was this bigger than life kind of person. And I just, I was a 22-year-old kid. And now, I'm a father myself, and I saw this being shared around on social media. And it was cool to think about, Aaron having a father and how proud you know, you, Gary, must be of him, and just kind of, you know, what a whirlwind that all must have been. And so I kind of just wanted to talk to both of you guys about the whole experience. I mean, obviously it's a wild ride, and I'm sure you get into a lot of it in your book, and we'll get into, you know, how that might be available to, sure, to listeners or
here,
viewers.
But here, I'll get this part out of the way.
There you go. And I have to talk to you afterwards about how I can buy one.
Okay.
There it is.
Yeah.
So, okay. Gary, I mean,
all right,
take the floor is yours. I mean, talk about this book and kind of what it's about.
Well, you know, I didn't start out to write a book. And at the beginning, when you know, I was happy to, you know, watch Aaron play and so on. But my big thing was, since I have asthma, and this is the days whenever people could smoke indoors, I was, honest to God, afraid to go to an indoor show. So I didn't see very many shows, but I was curious. But the event that occurred was when Strangers with Candy won that thing on MTV for the ultimate cover band. And Aaron called me up and he said, "Dad, you got to come to a show. It's different now." And okay, I'm a writer. I want to see this. I'm excited because I watched this thing on MTV like twice, three times maybe. And I went and I was, you know, transformed in a way, you know, a couple different reasons. You know, one was simply pride, like what you mentioned, you know, oh, geez, that's my kid doing that. But secondly, like the idea that playing a guitar had that much charisma to make people behave in a certain way. So then the writer part kicked in, like people, you know, consciously, you know, crashing into each other and having the time of their lives because, you know, they could mosh and so on. Who were these people? And just third, I loved it. You know, I got to admit, I mean, I went to that, and the next weekend I was there again.
You became a metalhead.
And the next weekend I was there again, and they couldn't get rid of me. And at some point I decided to write an essay about that initial experience. Okay, so I did that. And by that time, you know, I'd been there 7-8 times. And I said, you know, maybe I'll just keep going. I mean, you know, I love doing this. It's a whole lot more fun than sitting upstairs here in my room, you know, writing in private, writing literary short stories. So what I did was I showed that essay to everybody in Strangers with Candy, who became Lifer. And I said, "What do you think?" And the only person who hesitated was Aaron. You know, I don't blame him in a way. The other guys were like, "Yeah, you know," and so on. And then the issue became, if I'm going to do this, because I tried interviewing them. And when Aaron's dad is interviewing you about the band, they all put on a face, like they would if they were at the principal's office, you know. And I just gave up on that idea, and I said, you know how to do this? I just got to be there over and over and over again until I'm just somebody in the room and I'm invisible.
Right.
And then it worked. And then for the most part, I'd say, you know, at least when, you know, they more or less acted the way they would if I weren't there.
Sure.
And then the rest of it just took off. It stopped and started, I guess, maybe. I don't want to go on too long about it. But it followed Lifer, and I thought that was the book. You know, I'm going to follow. He became Lifer, and here comes the record, and then here they go. It didn't quite work out that way. And I remember putting it away when Aaron got discouraged and Lifer didn't take off. And then the extraordinary part is, you know, and he hooked up with Breaking Benjamin. And then within 2 months, that took off. And this time, Aaron did encourage me in his sort of modest way. And he said, "You ought to get that book out of your drawer, Dad." And yeah. And then I restarted, and it became sort of like half and half, a book about the development up until getting sort of known. And then the second part is, wow, here's when it begins to fly. And it takes it right up to the very end of 2003.
Okay.
Right as they're about to record the second CD, which is the one that changed their lives.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll never forget my dad. You mentioned the story with Strangers with Candy. My dad, who was never an MTV watcher, I don't know what happened, or I don't know if you heard about it, or just flicking through. He goes, he yells upstairs, "John, there's this band from Wilkes-Barre on MTV." And I run downstairs and I was like, "Wow, this is crazy." So yeah, that's cool. It's just a whole, like, it's just this whole thing. And I mean, what was it like for you to see your son go from, you know, obviously you've been a big supporter of his throughout the years, leading up to all that. I mean, did you ever imagine that, you know, this would be who your son would become?
No, I guess, you know, but on the other hand, not shocked, I guess, you know, not like stunned, but surprised in the sense that this is so unlikely, because there's so many ways it can go wrong, so many ways that people who are really good at something don't get discovered and don't get hurt. But once I saw, you know, the MTV thing, was like, okay, there's a lucky break. But when I watched them play that very first time, after MTV, when the room was packed with people and all the fire laws were broken and everything else, I just said, damn, these guys are good at what they do. And then I started to think, like, in fact, I know what I did. I said, you guys are good enough. I'm just going to ante up the money so you can go record CD, and you can pay me back whenever you have enough sales. Who knew? Who knew that, you know, I got repaid in less than a month, because it blew up at least locally and regionally. It sure did. So that wasn't, you know, but then it became a kind of disappointment, you know, because at some point you go, oh, this isn't going to be, you know, that arc. It's going to be, you know, the lower arc. And then the Breaking Benjamin thing, the same thing happened, you know, because I'd seen Aaron was in an earlier version of Breaking Benjamin way, way back when they won Battle of Bands at Susquehanna University, which is where I taught for all those years. And one part of their prize was they got to open for the guest musical group that semester, and it was Cypress Hill.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about a marriage not made in heaven.
Oh, it was fun.
Was it? Okay. Yeah. We went to that, my wife and I, and I said, okay. And when they came out, like, I don't know, 100 kids from local, you know, people all rushed up by the stage, and they were, yeah, okay. And meanwhile, 500 kids from the college are sitting going, huh, you know, we're Cypress Hill, you know, kind of thing. And I'm glad Aaron had a good time. But it was after the MTV thing. And then I forget where the show is now off the top of my head, Jitterbugs or Jimmy's or one of those places. And I went to watch Breaking Benjamin after Aaron was playing with them for a month or so. And I just watched the room. And I just knew it. You know, you could just tell from the room. Now we had the audience was diverse. You know, Lifer, you know, had these hardcore fans, but there were people at Breaking Benjamin. Those people were still there, but then there were guys in fraternity jackets there. And I said, uh-oh. And there was lots of girls. And I said, they have an audience. This music is broader, you know, for reaching an audience. And then I wasn't surprised at anything that happened, really.
Yeah.
Not for years. And it was just fun to, you know, watch this ride take off.
Real quick, before we get too much further, you mentioned, you know, you kind of ended up for Lifer and you know, helped them with money to record. And you said that it didn't really quite happen the way you thought it would. Aaron, can you kind of, I know the story, but just for anyone listening who may not, you know, what was the speed bump in the road, so to speak, for Lifer? Because there was a lot of attention on you guys. You had the record deal, and then what happened?
I think it was kind of a number of things that kind of all kind of came together in a not so good way. I mean, the good news is that we got a record deal and got to make, you know, a high budget album with Alex from the band Rush. So that's a win right there. But so the record kind of got shelved for, this is going back. I think it was at least, I remember we recorded it and it didn't come out for like 8 or 9 or 10 months. It was long.
I'm going to say 10 months.
It was a while. I mean, at that age, you're very impatient. So that seemed like forever to us. And we also, I'm trying to get back in that headspace. I think we kind of like felt we had some momentum going from being the band on MTV. And I remember one of the first things that happened that was kind of like a step backwards was they said we have to change our name. Because there was a show on TV with the same name. And that felt like, right away, like, oh, we just lost all the momentum from the MTV thing. So we changed the name. So then kind of that brand recognition was right out the window. And, you know, locally people caught on. It was probably in the Weekender and all that good stuff and word of mouth back then. But nationally, I think that when the record came out, there was a total disconnect of the guys from the MTV show to the sound came out. There was no cross-pollination there. So that was a step back. And then 9/11 happened like a week after the record came out. And obviously that was bad for everybody.
Yeah.
And it just didn't feel like, you know, kind of the world kind of stopped at that. And certainly the music industry kind of pumped the brakes on everything.
Yep.
And then I also think I think they threw out, we had a song called Boring and they threw that out. We made an awesome video actually at a club locally called Tinks. I don't think it was like a hit song. I think it's a hit. I mean, it wasn't so. Hit songs aren't kind of made organically. They're kind of, people throw a lot of money at them and it's kind of like a political thing. And I think Universal kind of threw it against the wall and it didn't stick per se in a lot of markets. And then we also didn't necessarily tour those markets to back the track up on the radio, which is kind of, you know, at this point, that's the old fashioned way to do it. But so kind of like once that they didn't see that was a big hit for them, I think sometimes at big labels, you're just kind of like, it's about the numbers, fortunately. So they could like you personally or think your band's great. But if the numbers don't add up on the paper, it is what it is. So that with 9/11 and everyone just kind of being bummed out and all this crazy shit going on in the world, you know, it was just a couple of things that just didn't quite, the stars didn't quite align for that. Although in retrospect, we did awesome things on a decent level. It wasn't, I don't look at it as like a wash or anything, but yes, comparatively speaking to the thing that came next, which was like a phenomenon. Yeah.
And how long was it between that moment, 9/11 hit, you couldn't tour really to support the record, and then, you know, your entry into Breaking Benjamin, I guess your re-entry almost, right?
Yeah, I rejoined the band that we started in about in Seals Grove, Pennsylvania, in 1998, I think it was. Mm-hmm. But we're talking. What your question was? How long?
Yeah. So that 2001 was, I think, when the record released. Obviously, 9/11 happened. How long between the release of that and then you rejoined Breaking Benjamin? How long was the gap there?
4, 5, 6 months.
Yeah. Okay, that was pretty quick.
Yeah, I think it was January of 2002, right after the New Year. Because, one of the scenes that's in the book is it was in between Christmas and New Year's. And I went up and Lifer had a show. And they'd come off the tour, so to speak. And Aaron was kind of down. And it was at the Voodoo in Luzerne. And I didn't know what to expect, but I remember the image that I used is that at the very end, they did an encore, and I'm pretty sure the song Breathless was the last thing they played. And everybody walked off the stage one at a time, and Aaron was the last one on there. And then he just laid the guitar down, and whatever, I get Aaron understands this. I don't know the electronics, but it was kind of like a feedback loop.
Yep.
It just keeps going and going and going, and then he's gone. And I remember I put in there, I'm pretty sure this, and I said, at that moment, I knew that he was never going to play with Lifer again. And then I just sort of held my breath.
How'd you know that?
Because you had more or less, it seemed like, more or less made up your mind that, to wait around for Universal to support a second tour was not a good idea. And so here we go. I don't know if I knew that for sure, but I was pretty certain. I didn't know what you were going to do. I didn't know whether that would work out and so on. But I was pretty sure that Lifer, as I knew it, was over. There it was. And by March, this whole thing was, taken off again. Because you're signed, Breaking Benjamin was signed, weren't they? March, April 2002, somewhere around there. Pretty quickly.
As a father, were you ever concerned? I mean, I asked a question about the gap between Lifer and Breaking Ben starting, because I was going to ask you, as a father, were you, it had been hard to see your son, with so much potential at that time, right? To kind of have the rug pulled out from under him. How did you view that? I mean, you were,
that wasn't
a big thing, but I mean,
that was a little spooky because, first of all, he'd been enormously lucky. Okay, you're on MTV and the whole thing flies and you go, wow, this is just coming out of nowhere in a way, because the size of their audience grew exponentially from that. There's an illusion that, this is the rock and roll story. And then it wasn't. So that's, that's pretty crushing in a way, because you can see how close it was. And second chances in this are second chances in Wilkes-Barre, away from media and all that sort of thing. That's fairly unlikely.
Yeah.
The beginning, I was just happy that, okay, he rejoined Breaking Benjamin, and now he has a band to play with. Now maybe he's going to have fun again. He knows these guys. He's played with them and so on. And everybody in the band was somebody that he knew and was friends with. So, okay, that's taken care of. The rest was a bonus for sure, an enormous bonus, but there it was. Yeah.
Were you ever concerned your son would get caught up in that rock and roll cliche lifestyle?
Yeah, that's the question I thought you were going to ask, because when I thought you were going to ask it, I remember my father was still alive at the time, and his reaction was, well, if that's what he wants to do and it makes him happy, okay. Because I could tell, you know, he wasn't a fan after all. My sister, who's only 18 months older than I am, was terrified, I think. You know, her first questions were all, you know, who's he going with? Where are they going? Who's he, you know, it was all those questions a mother might ask. You know what I worried about? I worried about the weather. And, you know, I would, when they traveled and they were playing Minnesota in February, I knew what the weather was in Minneapolis, and, you know, because that's what I worried about. I worried about that bus going off the road somewhere, or rolling over.
Think how I felt.
Yeah. I mean, so that's, you know, I really didn't worry about Aaron in that personal conduct way. And so that didn't really bother me. But the weather, I was thank God they're playing in Florida this week. You know, as somehow that was safer, you know. And so that was kind of a narrow way of looking at things, but that was my big concern.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, again, like I talked before about, you know, you don't know until you're a parent. And I, that's why I wanted to talk to you. Cause I just, this whole thing is just like a wild ride. And obviously you documented it in your book. And, so Breaking Ben takes off and, you know, in more ways than you could have imagined. For both of you, I mean, how what was that like for each of you?
I'll let Aaron go first and see where he takes us.
So I never really played music to, you know, to be famous or make money. I can honestly say I played music kind of for all the right reasons, you know what I mean? Just because I was into it. I love playing the guitar. I like playing the guitar more than I do now. I'm bored with it. But so I knew it was a great group. I knew, like, when Ben, Jeremy, Mark, and I got together, for lack of a better term, it was like magical. Like those four guys and those four personalities, the good and the bad of our personalities together, were like that formula. And, you know, the songs and Ben's voice and all this stuff, it was just like, holy shit, this is great. So even being in it, we all kind of knew it was above and beyond, like a rarefied air kind of feeling. But, and then we got a record deal, and that was, I think what helped that band a lot, maybe, which was lacking in Lifers, where Lifer, there was like a bunch of other rock bands at that label. So I don't think we were like a huge priority for them, maybe. Whereas we were signed to Hollywood, which is Walt Disney, basically. And we were kind of like their main rock band. So they promoted the hell out of it. And I think too, a big catalyst for the nation. I mean, obviously we were big here in Wilkes-Barre, but the second place where we took off was St. Louis. And there was a cat out there that played that song Polyamorous on the radio, and that became like a big hit. And I don't know. I don't really know, but I think we kind of got big in the Midwest and started.
Yeah, I was going to say flyover country. You got.
Yeah. So like once it was like hot in St. Louis, it kind of like spread from there, and that became like our stomping grounds. And we kept touring there. Like the first time we'd go through, there would be 100 people at the club. The second time we'd go through, it'd be like 500. And the third time we went through, it'd be like, it was like really exponential. So again, all that success was awesome. And, you know, I wouldn't trade it for the world. However, I didn't really as opposed to what I see with a lot of younger musicians, where it's all about the look and the social media and the, you know, I was never like an attention seeker in that regard. I'm an attention seeker as far as I would like people to like my music that I'm involved with or write or whatever. That I'm into. But I was never like a I want to be famous kind of guy at all. So all that attention and stuff was just kind of icing on the cake. And there are negative things that come along with that for sure. But so, yeah, I mean, I was kind of surprised, but we worked hard. It wasn't like we were good at what we did, and the songs were great, and his voice is incredible. So, like, we were surprised, and again, like my dad was saying before, just because you're great doesn't mean that, you know, you'll see the light of day or you'll break through. So, some of that was surprising, but some of it was also like a feeling of other people are hearing what we're hearing, being in the group, and there was a power to it. The four of us, I mean, it was like a force of nature or something. It was awesome. So I think other people, you know, I don't know how to explain it. So like when we played, we were like, holy shit. Like even in like Jeremy's dad's basement, we were playing and was like, wow, this is great. So other people saw that, obviously, the same thing I was feeling being in it. Yeah. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I mean, I imagine it's hard to really kind of, especially it's been, you know, what, 20 years now.
Yeah.
Kind of hard to go back and remember how it all kind of played out, but
yeah.
Gary, you mentioned you wrote until 2003, which is right before the next record came out, which I think was We Are Not Alone, which really catapulted the band to, you know, even, you know, much further than Saturate did. Is there a reason you stopped at that point?
Well, let me think if I get this timeline straight. In 2001, whenever it looked like Lifer was, you know, and this is what the book was, I found an agent for the book. I sent out that chapter that I mentioned, and I wrote a chapter about bouncers, you know, just another essay where I talked to bouncers and watched how they behaved and so on. And I used 50 pages in order to get an agent. This might not be what people are interested in, so I'll keep that short. But the short version of that is she couldn't sell the book, and there were reasons. One reason was, we'd like this book, except he ought to erase the father. That's my favorite one. And another one, the common one was, okay, let's see if this band gets enormous. And then we'll come back to you, which is, you know. So at some point, once Breaking Benjamin began, I published most of my work with what are called mid-list presses, like from universities or mid-list, meaning they're going to sell maybe 5, 10, 15,000 copies to a more limited audience. So I tried to do it on my own. Got a good match with Michigan State, and okay, let's do this. All right. So basically that was the end of 2002, and I had a contract to finish the book, which if I write stories too, but you can't write three stories and say, I promise you the rest of the book, unless you're Stephen King or somebody, so this way I knew that I could go ahead and write a book. Somebody was going to print this thing so I can make the best book I could. So I spent the first 6 months of 2003 trying to make that happen. And then at some point in the fall, it had to go to print. And that's kind of where it was going to end. And then I made a deal. I said, can I go back in December and write up a postscript, like write an additional chapter so it stays current? So that's what I did. And I went to stuff all over Christmas Vacation and so on, which was a great idea. But, you know, there's going to be, you know, as Aaron said about the Lifer album, there was going to be a six. So that's the end of December. So the book came out in August. So there's 8 months between, you know, because it has to go through all these stages. So it was never going to be up to date. That's impossible with that kind of thing. So, but actually, ironically, or by coincidence, whichever, the book came out almost the, I think, the exact same week that So Cold became the number one mainstream rock or active rock or whatever it is they called. I think it was called active rock back then. That same week that this book came out was the week So Cold reached number one and it stayed there for, you know, 6-7 weeks. So if I would have finished the book in August when it came out, it would have a different last couple chapters. You know, it would be about, wow, you know, this, you know, look at how many spins it's going to get on the radio. Look at how Hollywood Records is. What a different world, you know, what Hollywood is doing and what Universal was doing. So there was some of that. And so I was just watching it then, you know, although I, you know, I could probably recall incidents, but I didn't watch the same way. You know, I just went and had fun, you know, and just tried, you know, when I saw less of the band because they went national. And so I only saw them when they were reasonably close by. Because I remember for the book, what I tried to do near the end was it seemed repetitious to go to a show in Wilkes-Barre and write about it because the reader already knows that those 800 people are all going to be so into it, they think it's the best band ever. So I went to Washington, D.C. and watched. And I went to Utica, New York. I remember that maybe is better than any of them. Because it was the show that Aaron went home the day before, and then he was late getting there. And they were playing an arena show in Utica. And so my older son and I drove up. And we got there. And everybody's just sitting in the dressing room going, we don't know if Aaron's going to make it for the show.
I made it.
Yeah, he did. But it was, even that was fascinating, you know. But I learned a lot in that because the obvious question to ask was, well, what happens if you start 5 minutes late? And the answer was, that's 5 minutes you don't play, you know. It's not like a fiction reading at Susquehanna University. If I walk up at 10 after 7, I'll still do my 45 minutes. But if they start at 10 after 7, they're playing to 7:30 and the lights go out. And you start to understand something about the pecking order of these things and so on. But it was, that show was another way to demonstrate to me that this thing was going to fly because they were opening for Godsmack. And that audience, you know, didn't come with great expectations for Breaking Benjamin. And I could watch that and see how they won them over. Because that place was just packed with people. I don't know how many people that auditorium in Utica holds, but several thousand, let's say. And probably 50 of them came to hear Breaking Benjamin. But by the end, they probably had a couple thousand more fans. So it was magical.
Yeah. And Aaron, what was that like for you, starting out with Breaking Benjamin, opening up for some, I mean, I'm not sure of your, you know, who you looked up to and who, you know, you were a fan of growing up, but obviously, you know, Godsmack is a big, big act. I mean, what was it like for you, you know, opening for, you know, acts of that level?
It was fun. besides, I actually wasn't late for that show. I think now that I remember, I think I got there like 2 minutes before.
Oh, yeah. he got there on time.
It was, I think I walked in. They walked in, and I think I walked in the arena. They handed me my guitar. And I, but, yeah, the other, I think I vaguely remember the other guys being mad at me or upset, but yeah, I mean, all those opportunities were awesome. I mean, at that time, Godsmack was, you know, one of the biggest rock bands going. I mean, some of that's more from the fans' perspective. I think of those guys as my peers and or colleagues. So the fanciness of the bigger bands, I think, is more from the audience's perspective.
Okay. That
for me, a lot of those times when you're out touring and stuff, they're just kind of your buds or your peers. You know what I mean? So,
sure.
That being said, a good band is a good band. So we toured, you know, we toured with bands that I was fan. You know, I like Godsmack as much as the next guy. So yeah, it's kind of like sports teams too, where it's like the other team maybe can inspire you or you can learn something, you know.
Sure.
It's certainly too, all those groups, there's a learning curve to that world. Like my dad was saying, there's definitely a pecking order. Especially back in those days. Now I'm sure it's a little more politically correct or whatever, but like, I wouldn't call it hazing, but there was definitely like, you know,
sure.
You got to earn your wings.
Yep.
And you know, once we got up to the top dogs, I'm sure there was a little bit of that in reverse, but, yeah. I think we also learned, you also learn too. So obviously there's a difference when you play to like 200 people at a small club to like 20,000 in an arena or shed or whatever. So you kind of learn, how to play as a band, differently, because, you know, without like a big video screen or something, which we didn't have back in those days, you kind of have to sell it in a different fashion. Just like I'm in a small room here, so I can talk at a low volume, but if I was in a big conference room giving a speech, I would project more. So like, you know, in that band, in that world of a hard rock band, so like, you'll just exaggerate stuff more because you're on a bigger stage and you have to kind of sell it, the music, in a different way than you would if you were at, you know, a coffee shop. Sure. You know, so you kind of do that, opening up for those bands. And I think that's a great, like, I think to me, that's the correct way to ease into that. Whereas, not necessarily in the hard rock world, but like, you know, there's a lot of this going on now where it's like, well, I'll just bypass all that shit and go right to the top. I'll just go on American Idol. I won't even play any local shows. I'll just go to American Idol and get signed. So I think the younger, from what I see, these younger musicians kind of want to go right to the top. In my opinion, there's steps you need to take to get yourself up.
Of course.
You know what I mean? You got to play high school ball before you get to the NBA. So like, but I think a lot of younger people want it now, fast, you know?
Well, that's the world we live in now. I mean, Amazon, yeah, gets a package, you order it now, you get it tomorrow. Oh, yeah. See, Amazon's talking right now. Jesus. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, all right. Enough. Stop. Alexa, stop. Jesus. But yeah, I mean, it's a different world. It's amazing how things change in 20 years. But so you're with Breaking Benjamin. You do four great records, I believe. It was Saturate, We Are Not Alone, Phobia, and Dear Agony. And then you kind of exit the band. I'm not going to get into the reasoning behind that or the whatever it was. It is what it is. But then you kind of come home, right? You kind of, right? Am I right with saying that?
Yeah.
You know, you're home now. I think you're started focusing on your solo stuff, and you hooked back up with Nick Coyle, and you had Stardock Champion. Yeah. And we talked about the Badleys and talked about Gentleman East. And Gary, what was it like to kind of have your son, you know, back home, so to speak?
You know, when it first happened, I thought it was, in fact, maybe I still believe this, but at least initially, without question, I thought it might be a good thing. Because it felt as if Aaron wasn't getting a chance to shine, you know, and use his talent as much as he could. I remember as a father, so I didn't really get much of a vote. I told Aaron, I said, why don't you solo during these shows? Why don't you play the songs differently? And he did for about a month or two during Shallow Bay. There's, you know, you can find that on YouTube somewhere. And I remember Aaron's response. Well, the neutral response was, Ben wants to play it just like it sounds on the record. And then the sort of biased one was that Aaron said, well, you go ask Ben. And I remember, you know, yeah, sure, I'll ask Ben. I said, you know, geez, you know, this show would be better if everybody in the band got a chance to shine instrumentally, you know, and he knew what I meant. And he goes, that's not going to happen. And talk about being dismissed, you know. So, but I always wished that would, because by coincidence, one of the shows where Aaron got to play that solo in Shallow Bay was when they opened for Fuel at Susquehanna University. And this is April of 2004. So it's just when So Cold came on the radio. And he got to do that. I heard it that night. And I go, yeah, more of that, more of that. And the next time I saw him play, that was not part of it. So that was part of my reasoning. I go, okay, this is do your own band. And now you can do songs where you get a chance to, in a sense, show off and have extended solos and do that sort of thing, especially when you play live. Yeah, and it's always nice to have your children closer by.
Yeah.
You know, my daughter lives in Los Angeles, so that's pretty far away. And Aaron spent all those years, you know, being somewhere else, you know, most of the time. And my older son lives in Allentown. And so we saw a lot more of him at that time than we saw of any of the other kids. So that was part of it. And then I get to watch this thing all sort of happen again. You know, what happens to Stardock Champion? What's it say about having a manager who gets you booked in a way that promotes your music or, you know, anyway, it was, and then it became kind of frustrating. I guess I sort of share some of that with Aaron, because it's different, you know, and I believe Aaron, and I'm sure that's how he feels. I feel the same way about writing. I never sat down to try to write a bestseller. Maybe I can't, I don't know. But I was always trying to write the best book I could. And that's a different kind of goal, you know, so, but at least I want an audience that I sense there's an audience who's actually reading something I've written and for one reason or another appreciates what I'm trying to do for better or worse. So I heartily agree with that. So, you know, but you need the time and money, I guess, to be able to do that. I have a career in writing because I have a career as a university educator. You know, they go hand in hand. So I had the world's best job, you know, to go in and talk about, you know, I can just go in and talk like this, you know, about writing. And students would listen. But I also always had to caution them about the odds of you being independently financially secure because you're a writer are minuscule. And the same thing applies to musicians, just as it does for actors and basketball players and so on and so forth. So the good news is Aaron understands all that. And he's 20 years older. And certainly so am I. So I'm not going on tour ever again and so on. But he still has his talent.
Mm-hmm.
And he still has the ability to write songs and write lyrics and, imagine all the parts. I just think it's magical. What I remember is when he got a guitar and he'd only played it a few months. And what he could do was I would put on a record. And I'd say, listen to this for, 30 seconds or 45 seconds. And I said, can you play that now? And then he could. And I just, what do you mean you can, I can read music, and I can't play anything that I hear.
Yeah.
And Aaron, I'm not even sure Aaron reads music. Maybe he can by now, but he can play anything he hears. He's played classical music for me on the piano. And I go, where'd you hear that? And he goes, I picked this up. And I'm astonished that, it's miraculous in a way. I just hope it makes him happy and it's all good.
It's on a side note too. My dad is sitting in my childhood bedroom where I learned to play the guitar.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I used to make a racket up in that room. I think you guys would every now and then would holler up, like, turn that shit down or something.
Yeah, because the first band that you tried to master was Metallica, I remember.
Yeah, I was the best. Yeah. The
same thing over and over and over. I go, oh, no. And I would kind of make fun of, right behind me on that door, there was a little basketball hoop. We played Nerf basketball up here sometime.
Yeah.
That's funny. That's awesome. Well, Aaron, you did the whole Lifer and Breaking Ben thing. It was close to 10-ish years. I mean, was it kind of like almost cool to kind of come home and kind of remove yourself from that? I don't want to call it chaos, but the constant touring and traveling and, a different city every night. Was it kind of like a nice thing to just kind of come back home and kind of just kind of focus on,
Well, yeah. I mean, for me, on a personal note, like touring that much, I always missed my son and being a parent to him, like in, a hands-on parent. There was a lot of parenting over the phone and stuff like that. Back then there wasn't Skype or anything like that. So that was, for me, not career-wise, but personally, I got much more focused on being the best dad that I could. So that was huge for me. That was a win for me.
Yeah.
Then there was a lot of chaos with, like, my career. And so then I just kind of, doing what I do, I just kind of went on to the next thing. And for me, it's all about making the best music. Like my dad said, making the best music I can at the time. It is frustrating. It's frustrating to like do stuff at such a high level and then to kind of come back to, the Joe's Corner Bar. It's a little bit weird. It's a little bit of a mind melter, but I think if I didn't do it for the right reasons, I would certainly quit, because it had, the last 10 years for me have been a little bit, of an uphill battle, but I've been making great music, and that's what I'm, you know, that's why I do it, and I'm proud of that. But as far as like success goes, yeah, it's been a little bit weird, but I could see why someone else would quit and just hang up the shoes and do something else.
Yeah.
There's certainly days when I wonder what the fuck we're doing here, but I'm never gonna quit. I'm not that guy.
Yeah.
This is what I'm like. I believe I was like put here to do, just to make music.
I believe that. I mean, every soul,
you can see my whole house is like nothing but music, music, music. And
I see that Scorpion King on the wall. And I remember I used to buy a lot of soundtracks because they had it was like a collection of like great musicians.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget when I got that. I was actually, I don't know if I was in Philly or New York City, but I got it in one of those cities and I turned it over and Lifer was on the back. I think it was maybe been the last track on that soundtrack even.
Yeah.
I was like, holy shit, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sucker went gold, I guess.
Yeah.
Back when records used to sell.
Yeah. What a different world we live in now, huh?
Yeah.
That's all you need to do, Aaron. Just write like one like hit song and you'll become... You go right back to the top.
Well, I mean, actually, I'm super psyched about... I have a couple things cooking right now that I'm very excited about. So, obviously, with all this COVID stuff, it put an additional wrinkle into everything that I do. So, Lifer got back together, and we've been making awesome music together. And,
yep.
We actually have, I'm sure people from northeastern Pennsylvania will be watching this. We have a show at the River Street Jazz Cafe on February 11th. That's going to be a great, great time. And we have a song coming out the same day, which I'm super, super proud of. I'm in another band called Earshot. We have two songs coming out very soon. And I just made another solo record, which is a little bit heavier than the previous ones that I'm super proud of and psyched about. And that should be coming out, maybe in the spring or in the summer. So I have a lot of stuff cooking that I'm like really into and I think is great. So that's all good news.
That's great to hear. I mean, every solo album, I think everyone gets better. I think you put one out. I think you put three out like every year consecutively. I can't remember the years, but I mean, every one was better than the one prior.
Oh, thank you. I guess it would be the fifth. I think. Yeah, it's a step up. So
cool.
It's awesome.
I remember I found an Earshot back in 2005. I think, or no, it was 2004 when I was an intern at the Weekender. So it was cool to see it become part of that outfit. It was a great band. I love those guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully we can do some shows with that this summer. That's an interesting band because we all live in different states. So like, we're like never in the same room, but, and then the shows are obviously kind of like fly dates. So we just all kind of meet up. So, I think there's some that are being talked about and, hopefully that happens. I think those are mostly like festival type gigs. So I don't, again, with all this COVID stuff, putting an extra, wrench in everything.
Yeah.
Hopefully those will all actually come to fruition.
I hope so too.
Yeah. But,
I mean, I'm always a fan of yours, obviously.
Oh, thank you, man.
For what it's worth. It's a pleasure to call you a friend. And Gary, it was nice talking to you about, you following the band and Aaron's career. And obviously you're a very proud father. And I'm really happy we got to do this because me becoming a father and knowing how proud I am of my son, who's 4 years old, who's, he's four. He hasn't done the whole traveling the country and things like that. So I can't imagine like how you must feel as a father and a grandfather too. And it just it's a different way for me to think about things as far as how I view the world and how I view people, you know, being a father myself. So thanks for doing this.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
And where can people find that book?
Oh boy. The usual places, although it's been so long, you know, that they probably don't even have it in stock anymore, like at Amazon and all that sort of thing. But the deal, what Aaron and I were doing, was we were both signing the books, and then I was just taking orders and mailing them out to people. And there was big response. I mean, we were going to do this at the record store, the Gallery of Sound. And then COVID came so these books, you know, 15, 18 of them sat around for like 18 months, you know, waiting for, let's go, we're going to have this signing. And at some point I said, you know, I'll just retrieve these books and let's see what happens. Aaron has followers, and so let's see what happens, because one of those things, I mean, one advantage of having the world the way it is now about social media is you can resurrect this, mm-hmm. Whereas back then that book had its opportunity for a mid-list press book. It did well. And then it was gone, except they keep it in print. So there it was warehoused in Chicago for years, you know, waiting. And now I got a bunch of them sitting in my dining room that I've signed. And I got to find Aaron here in the next couple of days and have him sign the rest of them. And then I'm sending them out to people. I just have people get in touch with me on Facebook Messenger. I think is the easiest thing for me to say here. I mean, you can just look me up on Facebook and
he's
just go to
Messenger. The middleman. He's cutting out the middleman. He's going direct.
The other way is to order them from Amazon and so on. And Amazon will be stunned. And then maybe for years it said only one copy left for the last 2 years, you know, more coming soon. So maybe that'll happen. Well, Michigan State is all excited, you know, wow. You know,
well, you better look out, because this podcast has a million listeners.
Okay.
You're going to be flooded with orders.
Okay. You know, if you send me an address, a mailing address, I'll just mail you one of these things.
Right. Well,
thank you, President. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Well, you know, before we let Aaron go, yeah, since you're showing your book, and let's see how red we can make Aaron's face. Like, I have this.
Nice.
This is actually Scott Chaharsky, I think, took this photo.
Yeah.
And I got this as a, you were doing a benefit for Rich Howells, I believe it was, at the Kirby Center.
Yeah,
With Lifer, his parents' house caught on fire. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I entered this silent auction, and I took home. I have one of you and one of Nick.
Nice.
In my basement.
That's all I need. The toxic twins there.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys again. Enjoy the rest of your Saturday. I appreciate everything, and hopefully I'll get to see you guys sooner than later.
Yeah, maybe I'll see you on the 11th.
The 11th, yes, February.
Yeah.
Did you guys play there recently? Like, not recently, like within the last 2 or 3 months? Yeah.
No, that was, you might be thinking of Cold.
Was it Cold? No. It was with the University Drive. It was in the Jazz Cafe, kind of opened back up.
Yeah, like last summer or something.
Was it that long ago already? Yeah, it was last summer. You're right. I was there for that. So. Yeah. Cool. Well, guys, thanks again. I really appreciate
it. Thank
you. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. See you guys.
All right. See you.
Bye.